This is the Afternoon Magazine. I'm Celeste Quinn. Good afternoon. Today, the birth anniversary of Martin Luther King Jr., we talk with journalist and biographer Marshall Frady. Frady was a young reporter in the 1960s when he began covering the civil rights movement for Newsweek. The author of biographies about George Wallace and Jesse Jackson has written a new book about King. It's titled Martin Luther King Jr., A Penguin Life. Frady's new book on King is one in a series of biographies being published by Penguin Viking. Marshall Frady says King, quoting here, radically reordered the values and power system of the whole nation. He had wound up, as J. Edgar Hoover was not far wrong in fuming, the most subversive man in America. Frady says King, through nonviolent mass confrontations, not only remade the South, he also remade America. Frady says King, quoting again, did nothing less than recreate and redeem America itself. This afternoon, we'll talk with Frady about King's accomplishments and the work that lay ahead of him when he was killed in 1968. Marshall Frady has written for many publications. He's been a correspondent for Nightline and a host, chief writer and correspondent for ABC News. Listeners, your questions and comments are invited in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. Anywhere else, toll-free, 800-222-9455. Marshall Frady, good afternoon. Thank you.
Hi, how are you?
I'm fine. How are you?
Very well.
Good. In the book's introduction, you write about being sent by Newsweek to cover a story in a small Alabama town in the mid-1960s, and you call it a Damascus Road experience. Would you tell us about it?
Well, a Damascus Road experience, an illumination in the lives of more white Southern reporters than me at that time. It was just the discovery that there was, in those bland anesthesias of those middle 60s, there was a stir in the South, an immense moral saga, and challenging the conscience of the South. It seemed limited to at that time. Later went on to ramify, to challenge, in fact, the conscience of the whole country.
Yeah.
But it was a time of high moral drama, and it was a skin-shivering discovery.
Yeah. Now, at that time, by the mid-1960s, Martin Luther King Jr. had been a leader in the civil rights movement for quite some time. At first, very reluctantly, but then committing himself wholeheartedly to the cause. Talk with us about the early reluctance and how he became committed to it.
Well, he was largely abducted into it by happenstance when he was a incredibly young preacher in a church in Montgomery, Alabama. And there had already been stirring around him a great restiveness in the black community with the whole system of that segregated society there. But he had no fancies of plunging directly into leading that movement. He had formidably read for it when he had been in college, and had some large but as yet kind of undefined urge to play a decisive role, some sort of a decisive role in moral history, but this occasion ambushed him, and he was entreated by a number of members of the black community in Montgomery, simply because he had not been there long enough, and in a way, and was still young enough not to have accumulated any resentments in the ferocious politics of ego within the ministerial community in Montgomery. He just seemed the most innocuous and inoffensive and unobjectionable figure to lead the boycott, bus boycott. So he spoke one evening at a... he finally agreed, though very reluctantly, and spoke one evening at rally, the beginning of all the succession of mass meetings through the South in the years to come, at another church. And with his speech that evening and the response of the congregation to begin the boycott movement, he found himself suddenly swept up into it and as its leader. But it was by happenstance.
He was such a young man at this point, too. In his 20s.
Incredibly young. Yeah. About 26.
Yeah. Now, when you say he read for this role in college, he read for this part, this leadership, this role of leadership, what do you mean? What had he been working on in college? What had he been studying that had started to prepare him for what he was going to face down the road?
Well, he had been reading deeply in theologians and moral philosophers, Rauschenberg, philosophy of personalism, being that any system that violates the integrity and dignity of the individual human being is by definition evil. But it was the most expansive exploration he had made through theology and philosophy while that began, in fact, in prep school and then ranged on to through college and then into in Boston University.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Before he made the decision to follow his father into the ministry, he had considered medicine, he considered the law, but he chose the ministry. Why?
Well, the church at that time was still the central heartbeat of the life of the black community. As indeed it much continues to be. He had had an aversion to, he was a somewhat fastidious and be it said, precious young man, and not unaware that he had formidable facilities and had taken something of a distaste for what he regarded as kind of the vulgar emotionalism of his father's services and the services in Ebenezer, and the shouting and he had always had a horror of somehow being captured in the racist caricature of blacks at that time, of being captured in that stereotype of that they were emotional and just were not had no discipline. So he studiously avoided being shanghaied into following his father into the ministry at Ebenezer. But he got up one and had deeply contemplated going in any direction other than that. But finally concluded that the ministry in the South at that time in the black community still offered the single most promising post and position from which to affect change and to matter and to be a leader that would be listened to. And it just carried a consequence that nothing else that he could have gone into would have carried. And also, as he was advised, it's not in the book, but he was advised by one minister that, you know, it carries, when he was considering what he was going to do, that the ministry is opposed to the law and opposed to teaching. The ministry spans the whole spectrum of human experience and in a much more connected and alive way. So, but it was through a kind of deliberation that he finally arrived at the resolution to enter the ministry.
Mm-hmm. And he did it on his own terms. In other words, what I mean by that,
yeah, he decided he would not. Yeah. He would not.
He wouldn't be his father.
He would. He would bring dignity to it.
He would be. He would be more reserved.
He was a more reserved,
yes.
And a composure that would be, you know, it would impress everyone. But he was possessed in those early years of such a kind of ponderous stuffiness that when he was at Boston delivering some the kind of tentative trial sermons to in a minister's a church there. The minister advised the faculty that he felt that this young man, though he's dazzlingly bright and very articulate, just doesn't have the connection with the common people to ever make an effective minister.
Hmm. But by the time he gets to Montgomery, he seems to have that pretty much in hand, doesn't he? Do you think, I mean, by the time he stands up in front of that group of people in the church...
Well, something was loosed in him that evening. And he, in his messages to, it was a very respectable, decorous congregation in Montgomery, black congregation at Dexter Avenue, that he had finally decided to accept the call to the pulpit there. It was also a comfortable distance removed from his father's imposing suasions and influences, he felt, Montgomery, his father being in Atlanta, of course, at Ebenezer. But the sermons that he had delivered to that very respectable congregation were filled with these erudite allusions to... it was like he was continuing his university courses, and but yet underneath them, that congregation could sense this kind of pulsing urgency and a passion. Well, it all unloaded and came to be, came to happen at that when he addressed that kind of organizational citizens organizational meeting to really begin the Montgomery bus boycott.
It's 1955, and you quote excerpts from his remarks from that evening, just after the beginning of the boycott. And, you know, looking over these pages in the book, reading those excerpts, familiar with King's voice, you know, you can hear his voice as you read the page.
Well, his voice carries.
Yeah.
Has carried across the years.
Yeah, and I was...
I can still hear it, Celeste.
Yeah, I was a
Over
youngster.
All this, you know, span of time, yeah. It still rings.
I was a youngster, but I remember his...
Where were you?
I was in grade school. I mean, in the 60s.
Where?
In Rockford, Illinois. So, but...
Well, this was a yet more primeval time than that, Celeste.
Yes.
This was in the deeps, in those Eisenhower comas of the 50s.
Yeah.
And
I wasn't even walking then.
And,
so.
and it sent this premonitory shiver of something momentous and inevitable gathering in this little town of Montgomery. Even at that early time in the 50s, when that bus boycott began to stir, he began to lead it with that kind of oratory and soul rhetoric. Premonitory shiver of anticipation throughout the black community in the country, at least, and then journalists discovered him, began to come down, and I mean, for still so young, and also it must be said, unprepossessing a figure. He was short and kind of chunky and rather prosaic, anything but heroic looking. But there was something in that oratory, and in his passion that stirred even those white journalists in the deeps of you know that kind of spiritual ice age in this country in the 50s, and the fascination of the media with him as this kind of improbable but irresistible young mosaic, young Moses of a figure who was leading this challenge to, and the South at that time, it's really hard to remember over this stretch of years, but it was like another country within the U.S. It was, you know, like South Africa. It was South Africa. And a challenge to that kind of an order, being articulated and mounted, and his communion with the people, with the folks, with the masses that emerged out of that, just absolutely captivated white journalists at that time, and they're set in you know, over years, a symbiosis that was absolutely crucial to King between the movement and the witness for the rest of the nation, the witness through the media, arranged a little beyond what you were.
That's okay. I want to go back, though, to those comments that he made in that church. And do you have your book in front of you or nearby?
Yeah, just a second.
On page 34, page 35, those pages. If you could just give us a sense of, because I want to share this with listeners, because I don't want this to be a conversation just between you, you and me. I'd like the listeners to know, you know, what was going on back in 1955? As you say, you know, it now seems so long ago.
A geological age ago, it seems.
Yeah.
You want to...
Where it says here on page 34, where he begins, "You know, my friends. You know, my friends, there comes a time."
Well, I'm hardly fit to reproduce his voice, you understand. But I will essay it. He was, well, let me just go up a little earlier, to a rising anticipatory rumbling. At each of his lines, King invoked the history behind the incident, that is, the Rosa Parks incident of three evenings ago. Then he hung again for a moment. "You know, my friends, there comes a time when people get tired of being trampled over by the iron feet of oppression." And with that, abruptly, there exploded an astonishing thunderclap of cheering and shouts and stomping feet, seeming briefly to startle King himself as it stormed on to an accompanying roar a second later from the greater throng gathered outside. It had become, in fact, the birth of all the mass meetings to come in black churches and tabernacles over the South in the years ahead. And King's voice tolled on over the tumult. "There comes a time, my friends, when people get tired of being thrown across the abyss of humiliation, when they experience the bleakness of nagging despair." His voice was again lost in the ovation loosed by those phrases, no matter how improbably baroque in formulation. What would always prove the genius, the peculiar eloquence of King's otherwise cumbersomely ornate metaphors, was that they were the rhetoric of the human spirit immensely and elaborately gathering itself for slow and terrific struggle. He peeled on, "And if we are wrong, the Supreme Court of this nation is wrong. If we are wrong, God Almighty is wrong." King's shouts were riding now on the mounting tide of cries and clapping and trampling feet, seconded by the roar from the vast throng in the dark outside. He was released at last into that passion and power the Dexter Avenue Baptist Church congregation had always sensed under his Sunday morning sermons. The soul communion now beyond all scholarship and politics and legalisms. "If we are wrong, Jesus of Nazareth was merely a utopian dreamer and never came down to earth. If we are wrong, justice is a lie. And we are determined here in Montgomery to work and fight until justice runs down like water and righteousness as a mighty stream." And it goes on. I mean, it prickles the skin even, you know.
Yeah, even to...
This remove.
Yeah.
But when he finished... Well, it was the most dramatic instance yet of King's sharing that mystic capability of leaders of genius at certain critical moments to suddenly transmute into someone something awesomely larger than their ordinary selves. And in the ovation that kept thundering on and on, he then began making his way back up the aisle of the church, with people leaning and reaching to touch him as he passed. It had begun.
Marshall Frady is our guest this afternoon here on the Afternoon Magazine. He's a journalist and biographer. He has written a book about Martin Luther King Jr. for the series of biographies being published by Penguin Viking, the title Martin Luther King Jr., A Penguin Life. Marshall Frady was a young reporter in the 60s when he began covering the civil rights movement for Newsweek. He is also the author of biographies about George Wallace and Jesse Jackson. My name is Celeste Quinn. Listeners, I invite your questions this afternoon in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. Anywhere else, call toll-free 800-222-9455. Marshall Frady, back to this extraordinary moment. Here we have an ordinary man caught up in an extraordinary time, but yet he is very much a human being. He's flesh and blood. He's a man, and he has all kinds of frailties, doesn't he?
Well, that's really one of the principal propositions that in his story, and that I wanted to make clear in telling that lie, that he was an extraordinarily tortured and guilt-ravaged spirit. And swelteringly tormented and convoluted, but he and the point being that past all of these mass pop sanctifications now that tend to have the effect of flattening him, or as one of his prior biographers said, to commemorate him or remember him by really forgetting him. He was a deeply dimensioned and tortured soul, and always grappling with the siren songs of not only, in fact, affluence, and indeed, as he struck many, self-importance or vanity, grappling with that always. But also the sensual singing to his spirit, and the point of it being though that he presents a parable of how in fact complex and tormented and convoluted and in many ways marred our prophets and moral heroes actually happen to come to us in their own time. And it might help to recognize that about them and not expect them to be, he's been laminated into this kind of gilded, reverentially mummified into this icon and effigy now. But he was surgingly alive in every respect,
and struggled
with guilt over it. I mean, he compulsively was a compulsive amatory musket corsair. Let me see if I can put that more simply. Well, in some way, he loved women.
Yes.
He loved women.
There you go.
And he had a manner about him. They loved him. And he couldn't resist it. Couldn't resist them. And they could not resist him. But he suffered over that. Over that lapse into what he felt was his lower self. And passed through Gethsemane's of guilt and suffering about it, but it was like this ever repeating syndrome, this tension between the high spirituality of his calling, to which he had given himself over to, and these lapses into his lower and more glandular nature, which produced then a kind of sorrow and woe in him about it, and guilt, that then produced the struggle to redeem himself from it, and in that the spiritual power that restored him to this. It was a peculiar kind of circular process, psychic process with him. But he was trapped in it right up to the very last night of his life. To the last night of his life. extraordinary character. This is it's finally a character story, and indeed, in King's case, of a tragic heroic character and figure who reached, despite all of it, a kind of grandeur, grandness in this country's life. Mm. Don't mean to go on, but
we have a listener. Would like to talk with you on line one in Champaign. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon. I know we have made Martin Luther King something of a saint in our civic religion in the United States, and I'm sure things have moved along a great deal since the 50s. And yet, as we look around, we see problems regarding race still exist in this country. For example, we have more young black men in prison than in college, for example. Can you give us some suggestions on what we can do now to continue his work?
Well, I was Celeste, what you were reading earlier, he struggled to recreate the conscience of the time. He struggled to liberate, his people from the heritage of, or the legacy of bondage of subjugation and whatnot. He struggled to do that, but never finally availed, as this gentleman indicates, which is part of the track, but he could not cease, even when within the black community, disillusionments with his nonviolent ethic and this high spirituality of his vision. When reactions, he began to meet with backfires against that within the black community, and he still was resolved to follow that. There's just no guarantee you'll ever win. There's no guarantee of success, as he finally had to bring himself to, and the most that one could do was just to continue to try to humanize the wider community. But particularly in the second half of his life, he, beyond working truly astonishing effects on the public or civic life of the South, he aspired to regenerate the conscience of the whole country about its character and how it was structured, its systems of power and systems of predatory, as he viewed it, profit. He was, in fact, deeply socialist in inclinations. There's just no dodging that. But in that second, and particularly the Vietnam War, of course, but in that second larger ministry to the whole country at large, he just simply flat failed. And in fact, he was always, even through the movement in the South, was always to fail more often than he succeeded. But he's. It's that urge to civilize, well, as Aeschylus put it, to make gentle the life of the world and more human. Whether it ever avails or not, I think he deeply sensed it was that urge and that impulse and that ministry and that mission was, whatever it availed, was the only thing that had brought us this far out of the mouths of the caves. And close it, to the light. Describing a very wide circle back around to what the gentleman was asking, it would break his heart. That racial divide, with all the brutalities it visits on both sides, but more immediately recognizable and visibly and painfully on the black side of our people, but that racial divide still, you know, persists would be great despair for him.
Hmm. You mentioned that, excuse me, particularly with Vietnam, he began to focus thinking and focus attention on militarism, but that goes way back, although Vietnam and other issues of the day in the latter half of his career really focused his attention on that issue and also on economic issues. But yet that goes way back with him, almost probably to his college days,
well,
I guess. And then certainly in Montgomery, I believe that you say that he was talking as early as the bus boycott about the madness of militarism.
Oh, exactly.
And an economic system which is taking from the masses to give
to the classes,
right, to the upper class,
and our kind of self-interested blindness to the revolutions that were breaking out in the world at that time. This was the mid or late 50s that cast us almost in every instance on the. Well, he mentioned that the meaning of the revolutions that are breaking out, like Fidel's in Cuba, which in those years was one of the most, kind of romantic, democratic, egalitarian revolutions that had occurred within recent memory. And that we were resisting those revolutions around the world. He felt a great disquiet about that at that time. It was not, you're right, it did not spring full-blown with Vietnam, but his apostleship on against Vietnam was what brought it swarming to the fore, and also poverty, which he recognized was an economic inequity, which he recognized was a... That was a multi-racial matter. His vision just expanded beyond what had begun in Montgomery to the extent that it was almost as if he took on all the world's woe and anguish and injustice he somehow felt responsible for. Then came Memphis.
And in Memphis, he was in Memphis because there was a strike underway.
By the garbage workers, talking about the least of these, by the garbage workers, and it was a part of the poor people's campaign, which was indeed probably one of the most subversive mass initiatives, in certain terms, to be seen in this country at least since the 30s. And the garbage worker strike in Memphis, he saw as a part of that poor people's campaign as it was taking shape. And his aides did not want him to go there. They felt it was a digression. And they were having a hard enough time, as it was, mobilizing the support and the troops for the poor people's campaign in this encampment in Washington that was going to challenge the very, the most vital processes of the country, and that, that he's curling off to Memphis for, but he felt that it was exactly what the Poor People's Campaign was in fact about, and insisted that he just simply had to go there, and that's where he where it ended.
Going back to our listener who called in just a moment ago, it seems that King himself cast about for what to do. How to fight for progress, what to do next. I mean, after Montgomery cast about for some time, and then there was Albany, and that wasn't quite a success, and then it wasn't until Birmingham that he really came back and saw victory. How was it that he made choices to do what he did, moving from Albany to Birmingham to D.C. to Selma to Chicago to the Poor People's Campaign?
Well, he felt he had to keep the moral initiative alive, and that and this is during the his career and his ministry really is two part, and the first part is the Southern movement, and the second part is the, this much larger national moral struggle that he finally threw himself into. Through the Southern part, he felt that a sense of emergency and crisis was essential to keep the movement going in the South, because it would instantly lapse right back into the old patterns and formulas if it weren't being constantly challenged, and particularly to produce national legislation. And his two great achievements, of course, were the Public Accommodations Bill and then, even more momentously, perhaps the Voting Rights Bill that came out of Selma. But he had to cast about for the kind of front and where there would be a confrontation defining the right and the wrong of the matter most clearly and dramatically. And he was outmaneuvered in calamitously in Albany. That was a just an unqualified debacle. Montgomery, though, Birmingham, it was his real apotheosis. When the truth is, the Montgomery bus boycott really finally succeeded, owing not to the boycott, but to the intervention finally of
the Supreme
Court, the much-belabored NAACP's court suit. Producing then the Supreme Court decision. The demonstrations and the marches and the boycott may have provided something of the street energy for that litigation to proceed through the courts, but it was a court suit that finally won in Montgomery. In Birmingham, though, it was like the first time King's the principle and dynamic of nonviolent, massive resistance finally won the day there. But then immediately after Montgomery, there came St. Augustine, which was another flash out, another flare out. He won Montgomery. Birmingham produced, of course, Public Accommodations Bill, and then finally he won spectacularly in Selma. And that produced the Voting Rights Bill. From then on, it's beleaguerment, embattlement, distraction, and confoundment. And that second phase of his ministry, beginning with Chicago, it was, well, to say that, I mean, it was just a colossal misfire in Chicago. And he had come up against a firmament of interests and resistance that was infinitely more diversified and polite and elusive and complex and subtle than anything he had confronted, any of those palpable simplicities of what he had confronted in the South. He was defeated in Chicago. But this, as these defeats came one after another in the second phase, his expansion and his urgency just nevertheless, simply expanded wider, wider, and wider.
Let's talk with another listener on line one, also a caller in Champaign. Good afternoon.
Hi.
Hi.
I wanted to ask the caller about, to kind of maybe relate Martin Luther King's Christian theology of nonviolence and his politics of civil disobedience in relation to Henry David Thoreau and Mahatma Gandhi.
Oh, for sure. And those were initial, when we were talking earlier, Celeste, about how he had been sort of intellectually preparing and priming himself for what became his annunciation, however involuntary, in Montgomery. Thoreau and Gandhi had been profoundly a part of that, particularly Thoreau and the principle of civil disobedience. With Thoreau, it was wound up being individual. This Thoreau. King contemplated about it being magnified to a collective, to a mass scale,
Did,
indeed it was deployed in India by Gandhi.
Right, okay.
Yeah.
So that's where he made that move. And Gandhi himself was influenced by Thoreau.
Right, right. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And do you see any kind of continuation of his work? I mean, I know that there are... Well, there was a Buddhist monk that actually came over about that time from Vietnam. He was working for peace, he had some work, something to do with Martin Luther King. Maybe he received a peace prize with him. That was Thich Nhat Hanh. But do you see any continuation of any kind of approach coming out of Thoreau and Gandhi in the United States? I mean, maybe hidden somewhere?
I really don't.
Yeah.
I really don't. Things have become so diffused and dissipated and diversified, and there seems no great moral focus now. For a time, Jesse Jackson was contemplating continuing King's great unfinished work of the Poor People's Campaign. But it was just the spirit and the concentration, the focus for it just was. We're just living in middling times now, sort of in between monotone.
Right. Well, there's the new generation that has been somewhat active against globalization. Of course, all that
right.
may be called into question by the new focus on terrorism. But everything is now focused on one thing.
That is one of the issues that could induce a revival of a mass nonviolent movement, globalization,
mm-hmm.
and its effects. That would be a worldwide phenomenon. But there's absolutely no question where King would. I mean, one hesitates to make these conjectural propoundments for him as to how he would be approaching anything now. But I feel as sure as I feel of anything that how he would come down on the issue of globalization.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's a big word and it has many different meanings, but yeah. Okay. Well,
it's the barbarism and the dehumanizing of these large economic formations that always gave him the shivers. And even in his time, he was concerned about it in America, the development of a corporate totalitarianism, as it were, that was visiting untold mischief very indifferently and obliviously on the lives of individual people. He had something in his spirit, reacted with a kind of early alert aversion or alarm to that. So I feel pretty confident that how he would come down. But it's a much tougher thing to engage. It does not have that kind of guttural simplicity of a Bull Connor globalization. You just and that was a large part of his problem in Chicago in trying to deal with housing. Particularly the housing segregation and apartheid in Chicago. Daley was wily enough not to provide him with a Bull Connor or a Jim Clark.
So it became much more difficult and
to engage. It was like trying to engage a vaguely malign smog.
We're at the end of the time, basically, that we can spend together this afternoon. Before we go, though, I wanted to ask you, what do you remember about meeting King for the first time?
I was startled because the first time I met him, it was after Montgomery. And he had already become, he was already something of a legend. But I was startled by how, in fact, unimpressive he appeared, and also how stilted and reserved he seemed and withdrawn. And in his personal manner, that was tended to be the initial effect he had until one heard him speak to people. And it was just like something leapt alive into the air, a communion between him and the folks, the people, and a compassion and great surges of feeling that was you knew that you were in the presence of a figure and a force and a person absolutely singular that you were likely never to encounter again.
There's where we have to leave it, because the clock says that's what we have to do. I know you know what that's like. I want to thank you very much for talking with us this afternoon, Marshall Frady. Marshall Frady has been our guest in this portion of the Afternoon Magazine. He's a journalist and biographer. He's written a new book about Martin Luther King Jr. for the series of biographies being published by Penguin Viking. The title, Martin Luther King Jr., A Penguin Life. Marshall Frady was a young reporter in the 60s when he began covering the civil rights movement for Newsweek. He is also the biographer of George Wallace and Jesse Jackson. He's written biographies about Wallace and Jackson. He's also written for many publications and been a correspondent for Nightline and a host, chief writer, and correspondent for ABC News. Marshall Frady, latest book, Martin Luther King, Jr.